this kind of introduction to an invitation to
an introduction to an invitation to something or something like that. Okay, yeah, thanks, Gigi. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to talk about causal sets. Like I said, it's an invitation to an invitation in the sense that there's a course called Invitation to Causal Sets coming up in the middle of October. So if you find this interesting, it will whet your appetite to go along and see that. And that's Faye Dauker is going to be coming here, and Raphael Sorkin, who's here, will be sort of explaining this in more detail. So I just thought one of the reasons why we chose to have the seminar now is just to sort of give a warm-up for that. So the title I've put on here instead of that was Discreteness Without Symmetry Breaking, because I'm going to describe a discrete replacement for the Lorentzian manifolds that play the sort of leading role in general relativity that might be of use for quantum gravity. And this is a particularly nice kind of discretization with good symmetry properties. And we all know how important symmetries are for general relativity. So that I'll explain how and why that is the case in a few minutes. The first thing I wanted to say was something about the last case where we were wondering whether there was a kind of discreteness, and this was like over 100 years ago when people were wondering not about the discreteness of space-time, but the discreteness of matter instead. So one of my favorite pieces of physics is this thing where Lord Rayleigh, from a sort of casual observation, from a naked eye observation of a mountain, which he'd made at some point in the past, he was able to estimate Avogadro's number. Just from that, which I thought was a really cool kind of thing. So I wanted to say something about that. What he did was he modeled atoms in the air as just being small, perfectly reflecting balls, and then he used his lambda to the fourth scattering law to derive the following relation, where you can work out the number of molecules per meter cubed from things like the wavelength of light and the refractive index of air, things that were known at the time. And then he estimated the distance over which light is attenuated by 1 over E by remembering that he once saw Everest fairly bright when he was at somewhere that was 160 kilometers away from it when he was convalescing or something. So he sort of plugged this in, and he found a value of Avogadro's number, which was 4 times 10 to the 23, which is really close to the, maybe coincidentally close to the right answer, but it's exceptionally close. And it matched up with all of the estimations they had at the time, which gave a little bit extra impetus to the atomic hypothesis itself. So this was really a deep observation which gave a big clue about one of the most important things, or maybe the most important thing in physics. Feynman once called it the most important thing in physics, that there are atoms at that scale. So you can actually see that just with this observation of seeing that you can see a mountain which looks fairly bright from 160 kilometers away. So this is, I just thought I'd throw that in there, because now it's 100 years later, we're not looking at atomicity of matter, but it's atomicity of space-time that some people are hypothesizing. And in this case, again, we're equipped with some kind of discrete kinematical picture, which I'll describe, but we lack a definitive dynamic. So one of the questions I'm going to be addressing is whether we can make progress by proceeding in this spirit of this calculation. So what is the spirit of this calculation? Well, there's a couple of comments to be made about it. First of all, the picture that he had wasn't derived from a theory which they already had. So the atomic hypothesis was an input, not an output. It's something he had to throw in there from the beginning. So he had to sort of go out on a limb. Even though the hypothesis was accepted by a lot of people at the time, it wasn't a given thing. And other people like Kelvin were around at the time trying to derive the existence of atoms from generalizations of laws they already had. That turned out not to be the correct way to go about things. What he actually did here was made a sort of a common sense hypothesis, which sort of wasn't derived from the theories they had at the time, but was gained from a lot of experience and clues from the current theories, things like that, instead. And then he didn't just make the atomic hypothesis. He threw in a little bit more details and more educated guesses about what atoms were like, and he managed to produce a good result. And this is a long time before anyone knew really about the dynamics of atoms, so it was a long time before anyone knew the complete sort of quantum theory. So that's just sort of something to bear in mind as we go on. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to be describing the four following questions about causal sets. The first one, I'll just define causal sets for you so we all know what we're talking about. And the second thing is, why should we use this discrete structure to replace space-time and not another one? You might worry that we're lost in a sea of possibilities if we go to replace space-time just by hypothesizing a discrete structure. Why should we? There might be like 1,000 different things you could imagine which could do the job. So why should we have one over another? And I'll describe a reason why causal sets are particularly interesting. And then I'll describe how some attempts to build a quantum gravity theory on this basis very briefly. And then I'll get back to the original question, where can we look for signals of space-time discreteness, and how might we do a little bit of sort of phenomenology following along in the spirit of what I just said? Okay, so where does this kind of consideration come from in the first place? I'll be very sort of summary in this talk, obviously, since it's an introduction to an introduction. I won't give many details of these things, but you can always go to the other course or look at the paper I advertised at the beginning of the talk. So I'll just say that it's a common idea that Lorentzian manifolds may not be a good description of space-time near the Planck scale for the various normal arguments people give for quantum gravity. And there are several clues from the current theory that suggest the replacement should be discrete. Now, these are not only the infinities in general relativity and quantum field theory, which we've sort of learned to deal with more or less, but might leave a sort of uncomfortable taste in the mouth. There are also other reasons to think that when you combine these theories, you might really need discreteness to regularize black hole entropy. So pretty much any kind of idea you might have about what, if you treat that entropy of a black hole as arising from some underlying statistical mechanics, it's very difficult to see how it would be finite if we really do live in a continuous universe. So a lot of people think that in order to make that finite, you might have to have some kind of finitary underlying structure, and that's played out in a lot of approaches to quantum gravity. So here's an intriguing result which we're going to use later on. What I'm going to say is that the causal structure is basically almost everything about the geometry. So if you know the causal structure, by which I mean the light cone structure of space-time, you know almost everything about the Lorentzian manifold you're dealing with. Given that, and given the volume information on the manifold, the volume of all the regions, or the conformal factor, to put it another way, you have everything. You have the dimension, the differential structure, the topology, and the metric. So everything you need to know is just contained in, encoded in that very simple partial order. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Maybe that's the fundamental structure we're looking for here. It seems like a very simple one. So here's the sort of slogan that causal structure plus volumes is geometry. That's all you need. It's another way to encode all of that information. So if we did take that as fundamental, there's a very simple way to discretize space-time, which comes directly from that observation. So now I'm going to describe what is a causal set. He's going to be my interlocutor for the whole talk. So there he is. Okay, so causal sets are the following thing. They're actually just, in mathematical terms, they're just a locally finite partial order. So there's nothing particularly flashy about that part of it. For instance, like the light cone structure, the causal order of space-time is a partial order in this sense itself. So if you take two points in the space-time, it's a set which has the following order relation on it, which obeys transitivity and irreflexivity. Transitivity is just, you know, if X comes before Y and Y comes before Z, then X comes before Z. So that's pretty simple. In order to make a discrete version of that, we add local finiteness, which just says that there's only a finite number of elements causally in between any other ones. So that's all it is mathematically, but really if that's all it was, we wouldn't have used a new name for it. The fact that it's called causal sets is supposed to suggest that what's really happening underlying the manifold is that we have one of these discrete structures which corresponds to the original Lorentzian manifold in terms of the causal structure. So that order relation, which I've given by this sort of curly less than symbol, is supposed to be the causal structure of space-time, or give rise to it. And the number of elements in a subset of the causal set, that's supposed to give you the volume of the corresponding region in the manifold. So in this way, you can get back all the information. So just by counting points, that's the way to get back that one missing piece of information, the volume, which isn't in the causal structure itself. So there's a way to recover both of these things when you go to the discrete level. So that's a sort of vague idea about how to get the two things to correspond to each other. So what we're talking about here is taking the whole space of Lorentzian manifolds, which underlies general relativity, and saying that each one of those things is not fundamental. Each one of those things is just some effective approximate description of something else, which is now going to play the sort of fundamental, the basic role in our new theory. So really underlying that, there's some other space of things, causal sets for this talk, but you can imagine any kind of discrete structure you like there. And somehow we need to be able to tell, to get back to the physics we know and love, we've got to be able to make sure that we've got to basically answer the question, when does a Lorentzian manifold approximate well to one of these more fundamental structures? So mathematically, this is some kind of binary relation between elements of this one space and elements of this other thing. You can think about this as sort of solutions of your... if it's a classical theory, these would be like the solution spaces. If it's a probability theory, these would be like the history spaces for your stochastic process. And you can think about them as the history spaces in a sort of sum over histories quantum mechanics as well. So this picture is quite general. There's a few things that this binary relation has to do. It has to be surjective because that just says that each approximation is an approximation of something. It would be a bit of a useless approximation if it wasn't an approximation of anything. And the second thing is that a bit more of a physical thing, which will be interesting for us later. If you have two approximations of the same thing, so say if there were two Lorentzian manifolds which approximated the same discrete structure, they've got to be physically indistinguishable because we're saying that this Lorentzian manifold sort of level of things, once we've gone up to that level, this is just an approximation. If there's a difference between those two things which isn't reflected on the discrete side, it's not a real thing. So it must be something, if there is, that's not a physically meaningful difference. So those things shouldn't be things that we can use experiments to tell the difference between. They have to be on a smaller scale. So if there were two Lorentzian manifolds corresponding to one discrete structure, they have to be physically close in some sense. So I'm going to now describe a little bit more carefully how you can make a more explicit sort of discrete continuum correspondence like this in the case of causal sets. So how do we tell when a space-time approximates to a causal set? So this is the traditional blob manifold drawing. If a partial order is... So here's a way to generate a discrete partial order from a manifold. You can just sort of select a subset of points, just a discrete set of points inside the manifold like this thing, and then you take away from that the causal order induced on it. So if you can find in a manifold a set of points that induces a particular partial order, you say that that partial order is embeddable in that manifold. So that gives you some kind of way of deriving one from the other, but you can't really say that just because a causal set is embeddable in a manifold that you can find some set of points like that, that it corresponds to it or it's a good approximation of it. For one thing, that just having one element can be embedded into anything. That would be a rubbish approximate. I mean, everything would approximate to everything else in that sense. So that wouldn't be very good. You can't get back the volume information from this. You can put arbitrarily many or arbitrarily few points in any region. So what you really need is a way to make sure that the embedding is even over the whole manifold. It's not just embeddable, but it's what we call faithfully embeddable. What faithfully embeddable means is that the set of points that you've chosen could have arisen with relatively high probability from sprinkling, which is just a random process which evenly picks out points across the manifold. It's a Poisson process. And here's the equation which defines Poisson processes. It's just, in this case, it means the probability of getting n points in a region of volume V is described by this. So that's a sort of, it's explicitly just depends on the volume of the region. And in this way, so what faithfully embeddable means is that you can find a set of points which could have arisen from this process such that the causal order generated by them, induced on them by the manifold, is the same as your partial order that you're looking at. So that's the... Yeah.
How do you find volume in a Lorentzian manifold?
The volume is Lorentz invariant. A Lorentzian manifold in this terminology is a manifold with a Lorentzian metric on it, and the metric provides the volume. The metric provides the conformal factor, just the normal thing. Exactly. It's just the square root of G.
What's the motivation for a Poissonian distribution?
Rather than a different one, because in this case, it's the most natural thing in a sense. I mean, for one thing, it is the only thing which is completely completely invariant on the shape of the region, so it's the only distribution for which this relation is true for all regions of any shape, even the most crazy shaped things. So you might not think that you definitely needed that, but you do want it at least to be Lorentz invariant and invariant under all of the transformations that are allowed in general relativity to be the same thing for reasons I'll come back to. So there's a small gap between those two concepts, but this is the most natural one. So you definitely don't want something that fills up one region with more points than another region, for instance, because then the correspondence between volume and number of points would be lost. One of the main motivations is this thing I've written in green here. But this ensures for large regions, the number of points there is roughly proportional to the volume of the region. This rho here is going to be something like Planck intensity. So you want that to be true for, and in, this is the only thing that does that for all regions, at least.
So you have that true for such regions for any distribution that had the right mean. But we usually use sort of scale invariant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But if you have a fundamental length scale,
yeah,
you should be worried about it.
Well, it's shape invariant over the region. So, for instance, you definitely don't want the number of points that you're sprinkling into, or even the distribution over them, to change if you just boost the region or something like that, because that would violate Lorentz invariance. And so you definitely want it to be true for all those things. And then you get very close to saying you really need the Poisson distribution. I mean, sure, maybe you don't care about regions that are really sort of strangely and bizarrely shaped, like a fractal shaped region or some weird thing like that, but it's kind of hard to specify things which have, you know, do the job for everything that you want, and then don't do it for that kind of thing. It's something. Raphael, I think, thought about this at some point. You have to specify very arbitrary things. There's no real natural thing that does it apart from that. Sure, there's a little gap in there. There might be things which satisfy the physical constraints, but you know, wouldn't give this relation for really weirdly shaped regions or something, but. Those things are rather arbitrary and not very natural, so that's more or less why it is. Yeah. Okay, so that defines this discrete continuum approximation. One of the important things to note here is when I'm talking about embedding causal sets in manifolds, that's not to say that the fundamental structures are manifolds with causal sets embedded in them. The fundamental structures are really supposed to just be these discrete structures. They really replace space-time in this picture. The only reason that I'm bringing manifolds into it is because you've got to have a way of comparing them to get back the physics of which we already know. So the only reason these considerations of embedding come in is to compare the manifold with the discrete object. And you've got to have some way to compare the manifold and the discrete object. So something like this is always going to come in. Okay, so this kind of gives rise to a whole program of quantum gravity. The first aspect, which really falls into three categories of work, the kinematics, the dynamics, and the phenomenology. The kinematical part of the program is basically to investigate this discrete continuum correspondence. So one thing which I'll describe in a minute is to find ways to recover the geometry from the causal set. So given a causal set, how do you extract geometrical information from that? It's quite an involved question. The second thing is to prove this fundamental conjecture, which is just the thing I said before for a good discrete continuum correspondence. You don't want it, so I've defined the discrete continuum correspondence for causal sets. You've got to make sure that there aren't two manifolds which are very different, which both correspond to the same causal set. Then this kind of discrete continuum correspondence would fail. You'd have two physically different manifolds which you could ostensibly tell the difference between, or you'd think about as being physically different, which correspond to the same thing. So it would be nice to prove that wasn't the case. At the moment, we've only got, basically everything that we've done so far confirms this, and there's very good evidence for it coming from all of the ways you extract geometry from a causal set, but it's not proven. So that's something. On the dynamical side, this is really, since we're talking about space-time here, it's a Lorentzian manifold, not space, it's natural to use a sum over histories, quantum mechanics, with causal sets as the histories, and try and find a quantum gravity theory by doing that. So it's really a sort of very sum over histories oriented kind of structure. It kind of forces you to go in that direction. You couldn't really use a canonical approach to do causal sets because there's not really any information in a slice of a causal set. Like if you're doing canonical things, you normally think about, you know, information on the spatial slice. Well, what's a spatial slice of a causal set? It's just a bunch of unrelated elements. Things that are space-like to each other don't have any relations between them. So you just get a bunch of dust, and there's no real way to specify the sort of state. It's really a space-time structure. It's got something intrinsically sort of space-timey about it rather than just spatial. So that's why we're looking for a sum over histories sort of approach. And there are different ways of trying to get to that. One way would just be to generalize the gravitational path integral, so try to write down something like e to the is and write down an appropriate measure and try to sum over those things. Or another approach would be just to narrow down the amount of use some dynamical framework and narrow down the possibilities by applying physical principles like Einstein did to apply general covariance and the principle of equivalence in the case of GR. You could try something similar to that, which I'll also describe. And phenomenology is basically the thing that I started off talking about. So to use the spirit of Riley's calculation as a model of discrete sort of, and use causal sets as the model of discrete space-time, like he used this small reflecting balls idea. We could try and use causal sets just as a sort of hypothesis to test ideas about space-time fuzziness. So even if you don't want to, even if you've got different ideas about the dynamics of quantum gravity, this is a very useful toy model. It could be very useful to just apply it as a model of discrete space-time because it has some very unique characteristics, which, and then we could use those to sort of ask questions about what fuzziness of space-time could do, what new predictions it might bring up, if any.
So for this fundamental conjecture, you don't want it to be one to many, but you could have many to one.
You could have many to one, and you don't. I mean, it can be one to many as long as those two things are close. So if you imagine on the one hand, like in a more prosaic situation, say having some kind of discrete field on a lattice or something, and on the other side having continuum fields. Well, you could have some small, you could imagine two continua which just had small deviations on the lattice scale or something like that.
From
two
the continuum, same causal set.
Yeah, from
I'm
the same.
I'm thinking you could have several different causal set structures.
That's definitely true.
Same manifold.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Like in the case I was, so things that faithfully embed in Minkowski space, for example, they're things that you could derive from sprinklings, like a high probability sprinkling. So there are many different high probability Poisson. I mean, there are many different outcomes of a Poisson process which you can have. So that obviously, there's many different causal sets which are going to correspond to Minkowski space. That's definitely true. Okay, so I just wanted to mention these kinematical issues. So I told you in principle how to connect the discrete level with the continuum level. So if we're talking about getting rid of Lorentzian manifolds as the basis of gravitational physics and putting this other structure there, I've told you how to sort of do that in principle. But if I kind of got out from behind my back a causal set and asked you to tell me a manifold which corresponded to it, you'd have a hard time if the only thing you knew about it was that I wanted a faithful embedding. I don't want you to go away and start sprinkling every manifold in the universe to try and find the right one and then come back once you've found one with the correct sprinkling in it. That would be a very inefficient way of going about trying to find the right manifold that fitted your causal set. So what we need to do is reverse that process. There's got to be a way that if I get out a causal set from behind my back and said, I sprinkled a manifold to make this causal set, what did that manifold look like? You've got to be able to tell me what it looked like. That's sort of the reverse of the problem I just described. So here's a very simple example to sort of give you a real idea of how that works. How do you recover the dimension? So if I sprinkle, say, Minkowski space, and I do it behind my back, and then I come out with a causal set and say, you've got to tell me now the dimension of the manifold I sprinkled to make this causal set. How might you go about doing that? Well, there's about three or four different ways of doing this, actually. One of the most simple to describe is you just use this idea of the fraction of pairs of points which are causally related, which is called the ordering fraction. So in the continuum, this thing is this thing depends on the dimension. So if you imagine a 1 plus 1, a little interval, a little Alexandrov neighborhood of 1 plus 1 Minkowski space. You can convince yourself by arguments of symmetry that half the pairs of points are related to each other and half aren't in that case. And if you go up to higher dimensions, less of the points are related because less of the pairs of points in that region are related to each other. So there's a sort of relationship between the dimension and that fraction of pairs of points which are related to each other. So you can reverse that relation and find the dimension. And that's also true. So in a causal set, if I sprinkled Minkowski space and then I took out just a sample of those points, it should be roughly true that the ordering fraction is the same as it would have been in the continuum. And the bigger the region you're sprinkling, the closer that would be to be true. So say if I sprinkled a bit of two-dimensional Minkowski space here, handed you the causal set and said, what's the dimension? You'd look at it, you'd see that about half the points were causally related, half of them weren't. You'd say, oh, it was two for that reason. And you can... Sure.
Sorry, do you assume when you do this that you have one time dimension and the rest are space?
Yes, Yeah, exactly.
Can you do it such that, can you choose between, say, two time dimensions and four space and similar
I suppose it's not. I don't think it's true. The thing is that because the whole thing is based on the causal structure, this kind of discretization only works for Lorentzian manifolds. So it's like a... that's kind of a nice thing about it, I think, that it really is intrinsically Lorentzian. There's no kind of analog of this for Euclidean space times all things with different numbers of time directions. So in a sense, if you took this, if you took the causal set structure as read, it's kind of an explanation for why there's one spatial dimension and a bunch of other ones. I mean, one time dimension, sorry.
You talk about strengthening part of a Lorentzian manifold.
Yeah.
And then getting,
yeah.
But that wouldn't be the Lorentz invariant
sprinkling. Right.
So you, do you not have to sprinkle the
entire... Yeah, manifold? I mean, and right, so then...
What problems does that cause you?
Right, exactly. So you could say, if you wanted to do it with a larger sort of GR, sort of some different manifold, you what you should do is go through and you could go through all intervals and play this game. I think in the case of this dimensional estimator, this Mirheim-Meyer one, it applies to curved spacetimes as well. So you don't have to worry too much about what if you applied this to a whole manifold, it would still work. I think it's a conclusion people have come to after
the
testing it.
Question is, yeah. Can you apply it to part of a manifold and expect it to still work? Or is it
half of a right. Right. Well, let's see. I think. Well, as long as I suppose the answer would be yeah, it's necessary. So if you found that the answer was half in some part of the manifold, either it is a manifold of dimension two, or it would not be a manifold. So if this dimension estimator changed as you move around, you'd know that it wasn't a manifold. Which is another important question, actually. It's good to be, you want to be able to tell if the causal set came from a manifold or whether it's just some random causal set which doesn't approximate to anything. Right, so, and that would be one measure. You go around to different places in the manifold, look at this dimension estimator, and if it wasn't constant everywhere, then you'd have a problem. Yeah, so yeah, if it was in fact generated in that way, yeah, it should be constant everywhere. That's true. So yeah, that's another important thing. So, for instance, another thing that manifold-like causal sets have to have is that all of the dimension estimators you can think of have to match each other. So if you're asking me, if I take a causal set out again from behind my back and say to you, did I generate this by sprinkling, that's one sufficient condition. We're not yet aware of a necessary and sufficient condition for that. But that's definitely an important question. But we're getting there. So there are similar results for lengths between points and topology of spatial slices in the causal set, and a lot of other things. And recently, Faye Dalcombe and one of her students has found out a way to extract the scalar curvature from the causal set. So there are ways to get back the scalar curvature, which is very important for dynamics, of course. So that was a sort of major advance in the last year. So this is why. I don't know why that H became lowercase. Okay. There he is. Okay. You're going to get that every time. I've got to go through the eyebrow raising thing. Okay. Lorentz invariance. So this is why I think causal sets have got a sort of... This is a unique characteristic of causal sets which distinguishes them from all other kind of discretizations. So this is a sort of physical reason why you might want to prefer causal sets over other discrete structures, as I was mentioning before. So Lorentz invariance in quantum gravity has been a fertile ground for phenomenology, but it's a problem in the sense that people have looked for Lorentz violation and they're getting very close to measuring, to being able to tell whether there's Lorentz violation on Planckian scales or not. So this is sort of a real sort of hot area in phenomenology for quantum gravity. And one of the reasons that's sometimes given for that is, well, look at a lattice. This clearly violates Lorentz violation. You can only have a sort of limited bandwidth of fields moving around on a lattice. That's not Lorentz invariant. If you believe in discreteness, surely you should believe that there's Lorentz violation. So one of the questions I'm going to ask here and answer is, does discreteness imply Lorentz violation? And the first comment to make is that you can only really talk about continuum symmetries when there is a continuum. So I won't be reinventing Lorentz symmetries on the discrete level. What I want to talk about is when we get to the level where we're talking about continuous structures, do the symmetries that we want still exist there? So I'm going to talk about Minkowski space where Lorentz symmetry is global, just to simplify these questions. So I think the right way to look at this is the following. Does a discrete structure in and of itself serve to pick out a preferred direction in the approximating continuum? So what I'm saying is, like, if you think about a glass or a gas or something like that, that on the continuum level, things look rotationally invariant. Even though, I mean, who cares what's happening at the discrete level? It's the continuum level which you're concerned about here. So if the discrete structure, so when you're comparing the discrete structure to the approximation at the continuum level, if that doesn't pick out a preferred direction, then that's the thing that's really physically important here. So to ensure Lorentz invariance, our discrete continuum correspondence, it's not a matter of just looking at the discrete structure on its own terms and figuring something out. You've really got to look at the relation between the discrete structure and the continuum to work out whether it's going to be Lorentz invariance in this sense. And we also need that criterion of physical indistinguishability, like when are two manifolds close to each other. You need that to be invariant under the symmetries as well. So with lattices, I think most people understand the problem with lattices. I'll just put it in a slightly different way, maybe. So what if our set of discrete structures was something like a lattice, something like a regular lattice or some kind of graphs that we were mapping onto spacetimes? How do we compare geometry with a lattice? Well, if you want to make it explicit, it's really going to be something like, if you want to make an explicit discrete continuum correspondence where the underlying structures are graphs and somehow the distance in the graph corresponds to the distances in the continuum, you're going to do something like the embedding I just did. So you're going to say something like, the manifold it approximates to X if X can be embedded in M, and you're going to define this embedding in certain ways using the graph distance and the continuum distance, which I won't bother to go into. So if you consider Minkowski space and with a regular lattice embedded into it, there are many such embeddings related by symmetries, and each one does pick a direction in the sense I was talking about. So even if you define this embedding in completely coordinate invariant terms, just in terms of distances, you're going to find that when you come to embed the graph into the manifold, there are many different ways to embed it, and each one does pick out a direction. So however you embed this graph, there's going to be a direction in which the lattice is square. So in the frame that I've drawn these things in on the board, this is kind of a nice even embedding, which seems to give a nice approximation. This is like a horrible embedding, which leaves big gaps in the approximation. So if you were to put a field on this, you wouldn't know what was going on in these giant regions. But really, it's just the same lattice. It's shown in two different ways. So large regions in this sprinkling, so if very boosted regions should be the same as regions which aren't boosted. There should be no distinction between them, but there definitely is here. Large regions contain no embedded points, those highly boosted regions, in comparison to the lattice frame. And no symmetric discrete continuum correspondence is known for these structures, and I really doubt there is because of this problem. Every time you embed that lattice, you've already picked out the frame that the lattice is square in. And that's really nothing to do with having selected a coordinate frame on the Minkowski space. This hasn't got anything to do with so-called background independence issues or coordinate invariance issues. As long as you can define that discrete continuum approximation in completely background independent terms, just in terms of distances and things, but it's still going to pick out some particular direction. So there's no way of escaping this in the lattice, as long as you're embedding it into a Lorentzian manifold. So with causal sets, we can ask the same question. Does a discrete structure in and of itself serve to pick out a preferred direction? So the first thing to note is, as I was sort of saying to Rob earlier on, the distribution, the Poisson distribution, is invariant under all volume-preserving transformations. So that's an important, that's one of the reasons we chose this thing. So in Minkowski space, that includes Lorentz transformations because volumes are Lorentz invariant. So you know that part of the discrete continuum correspondence is fine. Okay. Secondly, the causal information is Lorentz invariant, so that when you're taking the causal set out of the manifold, you're not taking out any information which isn't Lorentz invariant. And the third, which is a bit more surprising, is that outcomes of the sprinkling process don't pick a direction, which sounds a bit weird. I mean, even if you were talking about a wheel of fortune or something like that, you know, the wheel might not violate rotational symmetry, but one particular direction on it definitely does. So if there's a random process where you spin the wheel, the outcome's going to definitely break rotational invariance. It's going to point in a direction. So this sounds like a really weird result, but this is really to do with the non-compactness of the Lorentz group. So if sprinklings picked out a direction, that implies that there's a uniform measure, a uniform probability measure on the Lorentz group by one thing or another. So you can't, there's no map like that between sprinklings and directions in Minkowski space. So there's a paper with myself and Raphael Sorkin and Luca Bombelli which proves this. The kind of map I'm talking about is equivariant in the sense that, so if you embed your discrete structure in Minkowski space, then there must be a map to the direction, and then that map, that when you boost the discrete structure, the direction should boost as well. So that's what's called equivariant. That means that the direction really is derived from the discrete structure, and there's no such map for outcomes of sprinkling. So sprinklings are the only way that people really know to embed a bunch of points in a manifold, which has this nice feature. So the point of all this is that random discreteness saves symmetry, a bit like in a gas or a liquid or a glass. You can look at that case and you can see that symmetries are much better preserved in the continuum than they are with a sort of regular lattice, like in a crystal. And we can see that, you know, the effects on the continuum level make things rotationally invariant in that case. It's somewhat like that in the case of causal sets, but maybe the results are even stronger. The causal set gives an equally good approximation of all causal intervals. So the thing on the left-hand side is a boost of the same causal set as on the right-hand side, whereas with the lattice, you get something that looks completely different. So this is just to illustrate that sprinklings look pretty much the same once you've boosted them, as implied by the things I just said on the last slide. So this is a very unique feature of causal sets and gives you some... It picks it out from all of the... From all of the ways of discretizing a manifold that you can think of, this is the only one that people know about which really does this job. And using sprinklings as part of your discrete correspondence is definitely a big part of that. Okay. Let's ask me another question. What's this one? How is supposed to be how you how we're going to make a theory of quantum gravity out of this structure? So now, one way of thinking about quantum mechanics is some over histories where you've got your where the basic structures of your things in your history space, which give you the whole history of the like the path of the particle or the whole space-time history of the field or what have you, and you sum over those things to give yourself transition amplitudes between two different states, or you can even generalize it and say and actually ask questions about things which happen not just at one time but sort of many times in space-time. So one of the issues which often comes up when people are talking about quantum gravity is, well, what about all the things which are non-manifold-like? And one of this is the case in graphs as well. So if you're interested in using graphs to approximate spaces, the same kind of issues occur. And so this is a very general thing for quantum gravity. It comes up all the time in dynamical triangulations and in some things like quantum graphity and also in causal sets. So the issue here is that almost all causal sets don't look like manifolds at all. Almost all causal sets can't be generated from sprinkling some reasonable manifold. Instead, they, in the causal set case, they look a bit like this thing, which I've got in the middle. This is a Kleitman-Rothschild causal set, and what that means is that roughly half the points are on the top and the bottom, and roughly half the points fall in the middle, and everything on the bottom level is connected to everything on the top by transitivity. So these things don't look very much like manifolds. The universe doesn't have a very long... So these are, by definition, three-level posets. So the universe only lasts for three Planck times, so that's not very useful. And the other thing is they have a sort of infinite scaling dimension in a sense. So if you look at how the time scales, it doesn't scale. So as you increase the number of elements n, the typical Kleitman-Rothschild causal set is still just three elements tall. So if you think about... If the scaling of the time dimension really... The scaling of the time dimension should really be something like 1 over d. That's how it should scale with n. In this case, it doesn't scale at all, so you can say it's something like infinite dimensional. And that's also the case for things like dynamical triangulation. So if your history space for quantum gravity is just all the triangulations of a sphere, you also find that the most common things before you put the weight on there are just infinite dimensional things. So there's a commonality here. And also in terms of graphs, what's the most common graph look like? Again, it's something infinite dimensional. It's the most crumpled thing you can imagine, because then you can have more of these links. So that's why there are more of them. There's more different ways to put the links in than there are in something that's more spread out and sparsely linked. So the number of these things grows super exponentially. It grows like e to the... Oh, there shouldn't be a minus in there, so that should be e to the n squared over 4. Yeah, otherwise it wouldn't grow very quickly, obviously. Yeah, exactly, that wouldn't be very good. Okay, so just as a toy model, if you were considering a statistical sum over causal sets, how could you get the manifold-like ones to dominate if the number of them only grows exponentially? So everything else actually just grows like c to the n, where c is some constant. So these things really dominate over everything else. So how are you going to get around this? With a local action, this seems impossible, and this was really a problem for dynamical triangulations when they first started doing it. If you sum over all topologies of the manifold and you just triangulate everything, the really bad, crumpled-looking triangulations, they dominate over everything else, no matter what action you put on. Because if the action's local, it can only make a difference that scales kind of with e to the n. because the action will only get twice as big when you make the volume of the manifold twice as big, typically for a nice sort of manifold. And that's not enough to overwhelm this giant factor of the e to the n squared kind of thing. So that's sort of an entropic problem. So no matter what you make the action, if it's local, it seems like this entropic thing just drowns out everything else. And that's really been a problem for some quantum gravity approaches. But I just wanted to point out one thing, which probably, hopefully, Faye will come back to when she's lecturing on this subject, is that causal sets really aren't local. So it's not the case that things that are linked in the causal set necessarily have to be a small set of close nearest neighbors in some sense. So, for instance, the number of links and links, a link in a causal set is a relation between X and Y such that there's nothing causally in between X and Y. So they're the things in these diagrams which are drawn by the black lines. The number of links grows faster than, the exponential of the number of links grows faster than exponentially in N for manifold-like causal sets, because it's not just that there's like four or five links associated with every point. The bigger the whole thing is, the more links there are to each point. So you can actually hope that there's a way to get out of this problem. And now that we know what the action is, we can start playing this game. And indeed, there is a way to sort of think about doing analytical continuations of a Feynman path integral to make it look like a Boltzmannian one and play the whole kind of Monte Carlo game, as they do in some other approaches to quantum gravity now. So this is a sort of very new part of the... So there's nothing published about this, so maybe... currently, David's working on this with Raphael and Sumati Surya. Another sort of older approach to what's the time now? Yeah, maybe I should plow on. But I was going to say something about this sort of other way of doing things, which is which has seen some progress as well. So a quantum sum over histories can be seen in a certain way of doing things as a generalization of just a stochastic theory, and we can. And, you know, it's been rather popular in quantum gravity just to use stochastic toy models to test things in principle. And this is a way to test this kind of in-principle approach to building theories in general. We can make a framework, a stochastic framework of lots of dynamics, and then we can put constraints on it from physical principles, and we can see what we have left. So in this case, the framework is called sequential growth. What you're doing is starting from one element, you're growing a causal set by adding elements to it, to the future or space-like to existing ones, and there's probabilities attached to all these things. So at first, it's just a very general framework. So here, there's two choices to put the first element, apart from this zeroth element. The first element can go in one of two places. You put probabilities on those two things. And then once you've selected one of those, then the second element can go in one of three places, and you put probabilities on all of those things. So it's very general at first. Then you have to limit this process by these physical principles, one of which is general covariance, which says that the causal structure you get after generating n elements, the probability of getting that shouldn't depend on the order the elements were generated in. Because those labels, those time labels, are sort of, they're just sort of like coordinates. You only want the sort of the causal set structure itself to be physically meaningful. You don't want these numbers which I've put there to be physically meaningful. That's a bit like, you know, labeling invariance, general covariance in the continuum. The other one's a sort of version of Bell's causality. You don't want things which are space-like to each other to be directly causing things to happen. You don't want things in one space-like region to be affecting things which happen in the other. You can phrase that in a stochastic framework. And then after that, you find that you've got a very generic set of models which all have very similar features to each other, and one parameter remains per element that you add. So this is kind of an interesting toy model because it's been able to... One of the things that's happened in this... is that there's a kind of solution of a problem of time in the sense that you now know what covariant questions to answer. I think I'm going to cut down on this. You can talk about bouncing cosmologies, which you notice in a lot of these models, which is very interesting as well. And it also, these causal sets which are generated in this way do have some manifold-like properties, but unfortunately it doesn't generate manifold-like causal sets, we think. But as I said, it's just a toy model, so... Who knows what might happen if you apply this technique in the quantum case. So that's still to be done. At least we've developed some mathematical tools that will help us in that case. So, okay, now I'm asking the question of where you can see these things. If we take this causal set hypothesis seriously, where can we look in the universe to try and get an idea of that? So is this discreteness consistent with observation? That's a really important question. And if so, can it lead to new observations and really sort of let us key into the discreteness of the universe? So one issue that's come up here, as well as, like I said, a lot of the stuff people have done in phenomenology so far has really been around the issue of Lorentz violation. But wouldn't it be interesting if we could have some kind of window into phenomenology from quantum gravity which didn't have to rely on that? Since everything else relies on it, it would be good to have other things to look for as well. And one thing that people have suggested is this rather generic, rather vague claim that any fuzziness in distance measurements will somehow cause loss of coherence of light from distant sources, loss of phase information. I suppose the underlying heuristic idea is if you have two photons coming to you from some distant active galactic nuclei, something like that, then because there's some uncertainty in the measurement of the space they're moving across and the time they're moving across, they might end up getting to you with different phases. Whereas if they, when they started off, they might have been coherent, just because that distance is very large compared to their wavelength, something like that. So even a Planckian kind of difference there might make a difference. When you look into it, you find that, you know, really underlying that, there is again a sort of Lorentz violating flavor to this kind of argument. Like when I was saying that, I had to sort of talk about distances and times, of course, which things were moving. And if you do look into some of the heuristic models that people have given for this kind of effect, most of them do violate Lorentz invariants. So people like Liu and Hillman had a paper about this, and that was criticized by a lot of people, like Jack Eng and so on. So there's been a little bit of discussion about this, this general point in the literature. But usually when people are introducing fuzziness in space-time, they're introducing a kind of Lorentz violating fuzziness. And there's not very many, no one really knows any ways apart from causal sets of doing this without violating Lorentz invariants. So what we want to do now is put a field on a causal set background, and hopefully this will kind of answer this question. So we'll say, well, what if there was a causal set underlying the manifold here? We're not going to do anything quantum. We're just going to sort of use it as a toy model. We're going to replace spacetime by a causal set. We're going to put a field on it, and we're going to see if the coherence, the phase information, is preserved over long distances. So in this case, we won't be looking at a mountain. We'll be looking at active galactic nuclei are actually the things to look at because they produce coherent radiation from synchrotron radiation, and they're sort of order a gigaparsec away. So that's sort of the maximum sort of thing we've known to look at so far. And this is also relevant for dynamics because if you can answer the question of how a field moves on a causal set, you've really shown how to recover some kind of effective locality from causal sets. You've defined derivatives on the causal set and things like that. So that's definitely useful for dynamics. So first of all, let's just talk about scalar fields on Minkowski, which should be good enough to answer this question. We need to make some approximation to the D'Alembertian operator. Now, the D'Alembertian operator, the wave operator... 2 minutes? Oh, okay. I started a little bit late.
5 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so this operator is both local and Lorentz invariant, and it seems like any way to discretize has to give up one of those things at the fundamental level. Like this thing here, this is just the normal way you discretize this operator on a light cone lattice, so you've probably seen things like this before. Here's how you write the wave operator in these coordinates, and you're just sort of comparing the field value at four different places, basically. This is a weighted sum of field values at a set of near neighbors. So you've got 4 points here, which... you know we're close to each other because they're close to each other in the lattice. But that violates Lorentz invariants, right? In a truly Lorentz invariant discretization, there isn't any such finite set of near neighbors to a point. Like I've already described this concept of link, which you might think, okay, so two elements in the causal set which are linked, they're close. So maybe, you know, if you just look at the set of things which is linked to a particular element, they'll all be close together. Well, they're not actually all close together. They're all close to the starting point, but they actually cover the whole light cone of that point. Because it's Lorentz invariant, if there's one here, there's more than likely to be one there all the way down the light cone from this kind of argument. So if you've got any way to define nearest neighbors in a sprinkling, you sprinkle points, and even forgetting about the causal set for now, if you just want to define some nearest neighbor in a Lorentz invariant way, you're always going to have an infinite number of them. If there's some probability of having a nearest neighbor fall into this region D in the sprinkling, then you've got to have the same probability for it to fall in D prime because it's related by boost and so on and so on. They're all disjoint regions, so you're definitely, if the probability is non-zero, you're always going to have an infinity of these things going down the light cone. So what this is saying, really, it's just something very basic about Lorentzian geometry. A a neighborhood around a point isn't, can't be Lorentz invariant and finite. You know, like a Lorentz invariant neighborhood around a point in a Lorentzian manifold is, goes off all the way down the light cone. It's got infinite volume. So it's misleading to think about the Euclidean analog in this case, where there's a nice finite sort of rotationally symmetric region about every point. There's something very different about Lorentzian geometry. So it's only really in the continuum that you can have these local things which are Lorentz invariant. As soon as you go a little bit away from the point, you find this infinite volume thing, which messes you up. So you can really only choose between having some residual locality or having Lorentz invariance here. That's a sort of very important thing. So in causal sets, sure, it's got this non-local character, but that's what we use to save Lorentz invariance. So unfortunately, because of that, we can't define a sort of finite difference operator to use as our derivative like you can on a lattice, so we have to be a bit more clever about it. And I'll very quickly describe how you do this. So instead of using the D'Alembertian directly, you can use the Green's function. You can discretize the Green's function instead. So on Minkowski space, that's got a very nice causal form to it. This is a Green's function here, and it's just a delta function on the forward light cone at the point x. So you can already see that this is something which should be easy to discretize in the causal set. It's so that these linked elements, I told you already that they kind of hug the light cone. So we can define that a function which says, you know, if two elements are linked, then that function will be 1, and if they're not linked, then it's 0. And so this is something like, if you look in a sprinkling, this function is going to approximate to the light cone. It's going to give you elements which lie all the way around the light cone. And indeed, in the limit of dense sprinkling, so in the continuum limit, you find that this function does go to the delta function. So this is kind of a, if this was the delta function, if this was the Green's function on the discrete level, then when you take the continuum limit, you get back the normal Green's function. So this is kind of a, this is a way to discretize those continuum Green's functions. And that gives you everything you need to know to solve our problem that I had at the beginning. So a Green's function is kind of like an inverse of the D'Alembertian, and you just take the same relation on the discrete side. Skip that bit. So then what I was going to say at the end of this is that you can actually set up a little situation. So I'll skip over the details of this now. You can set up a situation in which there's a simple, this is a source and this is a detector, so this is your AGN and this is your detector back on Earth, and this thing's supposed to be moving around, and then it's creating a field which you're integrating over in your detector, and you're detecting this field coming back to you. And you're asking the question, will this preserve coherence as this source moves around? So here's the continuum version of it, which is pretty easy. Basically, one way of putting this is that the result you're getting out at the end is just a measure of the pairs of points which are null-related because of the Green's function. You're integrating over everything here. You're integrating over everything here in these two integrals, and you're only picking out the pairs of points which are null-related to each other because of the delta function in the Green's function. And this kind of has a clear causal set analog. So instead of just looking at all the points which are null-related, we now look at a sprinkling of that, and we just look at all the points which are linked. That was my new Green's function. So you can do an analog of this in the causal set case, which is fairly easy to set up. And what you find is that there's no loss of coherence in this case. The difference between the causal set result and the continuum result is really negligible in any sense of the word, even for very stringent constraints. And we use a particular AGN or the distance to a typical AGN and plug it into these equations and things, and the possible errors that you'd get or the possible discrepancies in the causal set case from the continuum one are really, really too small to see. So that's good in the sense that it shows that the causal set hypothesis in this simple model is consistent with what we really see. It's bad in the sense that you might have wanted just a little discrepancy which you could actually go and test, which would have been more exciting. But it's something which is interesting for everyone who's working on quantum gravity phenomenology is this general point that space-time fluctuations introducing any kind of fuzziness doesn't necessarily lead to loss of coherence. So this paper will be appearing, it's me and Faye Dauker and Raphael Sorkin, it will be appearing in 2 or 3 days, and you can go through all the details and it shows this point. So not every kind of space-time fluctuation is going to lead to loss of coherence of light, because here we have a counterexample to that. And it's kind of interesting just because this is a really Lorentz invariant way of introducing this fuzziness, and it has a lot of surprising properties, so it's interesting to think about from this point of view. And maybe there are other sort of ways of applying these kinds of ideas to get more get more windows into phenomenology. And there are other projects going on in causal sets which are looking for phenomenology of different types as well. Okay, I'll skip all of that. That was trying to define the Dillon version in a different way. Okay, so the conclusions are the things I've been saying all the way through the talk. The causal set is a discretization of space-time that's consistent with the symmetries of GEI, specifically local events invariants. And you can define fields on a causal set if you allow for this kind of causal non-locality, which I skipped over a little bit of that, but that's also available. So if you look at the review that I originally specified, you can find all of these papers. The last point is that Lorentz violation and loss of coherence of light from distant sources can both be avoided in these sort of discrete space-time models if you use this particular structure. So those are the main messages. So that's it. Okay.
Most of what you described sounded very classical.
Yes.
Especially when it came to the space-time structure.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get quantum in there?
Right. So, as I described, it's particularly the last part of the talk was basically classical in the same sense as Varley's kind of thing was classical. He didn't know about quantum mechanics, and neither did he need to do some phenomenology. So, in that part of it, I feel comfortable about that. In the other part of it. If you look at a quantum sum over histories for, say, a particle, you don't need to... It's not the histories which are quantized in some sense. It's just that you have the same history space, well, albeit that the histories are sort of not unsmooth or something. But you have a history space of things which describe a definite place for the particle at every moment in time, and then you put on that some path integral, some Feynman path integral. So in this case, that's where the quantum's going to come from. You've got a space of structures which you can define, which just describe in totality everything about the universe or the history, the system you're interested in, and then you're going to put on that some Feynman path integral type of thing. So on this, there'll be... So all I didn't really go into very much detail about how we're going to do that, but how we're... At the moment, it's going to be a bit like in causal dynamical triangulations, if people are familiar with this approach, where you can sort of simulate the Feynman path integral by doing a Wick rotation, making a statistical path integral, and sort of extracting expectation values for observables from such things. So you can do something quantum with such systems. So in CDTs, again, the history space, the things just look like triangulations of normal classical manifolds, if you like. Not very at the moment. So that's really in the stage of being worked out. But all the groundwork for it really sort of appeared last year. So this is sort of a new thing in causal set theory. So things are now progressing in that direction. There's been a number of years where nothing like this was really possible. And then now we've got the action. We know what the scalar curvature is, how to approximate that in the causal set, which is a good thing to use for the action. And secondly, we now know how to sort of, or we've got some ideas about how to do an analytical continuation, so to go from some kind of e to the is expression to something like e to the minus s expression. So like this, usually people do this by Wick rotation, but you can say analytically continue the math parameter in a normal path integral, and you can get something which looks just like which only has real valued weights. And you can do something similar to that in this case. So yeah, so these kinds of parts just fell into place very recently, so we'll be playing around with those ideas in the near future. Yeah.
So at what point you talked about not wanting any causal connections when you're generating a
right.
causal set? I wasn't sure what you meant by that, given that your notion of what space-like separation is supervenes on top of your causal structure. So how could you ever have two things deemed space-like separated but yet causally connected?
Ah, right. Well, in this case, like these lines between things, they're causally connected in the relativistic causal structure sense, in the light cone structure sense. So how you define this thing, this kind of version of Bell causality, is to say something like, say it's a sequential growth thing. So say you've built up a little bit of a causal set up to here. So all this is causal set. Maybe I should draw something. And then you want to say, what's the probability of an element appearing over here or another one appearing over here? you don't want those things to be correlated unless there's something down here which is some common cause, just like you would normally. So it, I wouldn't say that the causation in the sort of philosophical sense was identified with causality in the relativist sense. There is a way to sort of define this condition. Maybe it's best to sort of, I can show you in detail how they define it. It's very similar to how Bell defines it. It's just that the events you're talking about happening in space-like regions are possible kind of extensions of the causal set. And you can definitely tell whether those are space-like to each other or not. You look at the possible extension, and then you look at the other possible extension, you see that their whole pasts are, or you see that the regions in which those two things happen are space-like to each other. And then you try to decide to yourself whether... Then you want those things to be uncorrelated given everything in the past, basically. So it's like a principle of common cause. I mean, as you know very well, I mean, this isn't really true in real life, of course, because of quantum correlation. So this is just something for the classical kind of... This is something we put in for just the classical model.
I'll pick up on that. You talked about what they've caught us at some point.
Yeah.
And I've always puzzled on this, how you can talk about building a causal setup to some point.
Yeah.
It would seem that that's broken all of the rules in terms of causal set being a spring thing. You can't actually know.
Right, exactly. It's not really physical this time.
At that point, you're definitely not going to find a corresponding manifold.
Well, if you build up...
If you turn that six as far as that comes,
yeah.
There's no future in it, and then you don't have any variance.
Right. If you do stop, then you won't find. Well, definitely you won't find Minkowski space because that goes on forever. But you won't find. I mean, the thing, this idea that you can pause at a certain stage is not really covariant. So really, you have to continue this process to infinity, and then you can talk about. So when I mentioned this problem of time, that comes in. This version of the problem of time. It's relevant for this question. So really, to get the probabilities you're interested in, you want this process to go all the way to infinity, and then you want to wash out these numbers. So the order in which the things are generated shouldn't matter. And there is a well-defined process to get rid of those ordering labels. But yeah, building up to a certain time, paradoxically, I mean, when you define this version of Bell locality, it does use these labels. So that's a sort of problematic sort of part of it, maybe. Yeah.
So you started off telling us about how Lord Valley could see discreteness somehow by looking at the distant mountain.
Yeah.
But then you, so we'd like to be able to do something like that for quantum gravity.
Yeah.
And you said here that with this Lorentz invariant discreteness, we don't see loss of coherence.
Yeah.
Coherence.
Yeah, and unfortunately it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah.
So can you say something about something we might hope to see as a signature?
Yeah. Right. So I mean. The things that go through your mind are things like attenuation and scattering and so on. And there's because those are the things you see in the case of matter, so there might be sort of analogs of those. One of these things is this idea of that the momentum of particles might not be absolutely conserved in a discrete universe because the past is essentially random as the things moving through it, and the path of a particle can't be infinitely accurately defined just by looking at a small duration into the past on the particle's path, you're only going to have a finite amount of elements in its path or a finite region in its path, and that can't absolutely well define for you a trajectory. Right? So then you might ask yourself, well, how good are these trajectories? Maybe they. What would happen if those trajectories weren't exactly deterministic? What if they, because of the sprinkling, because of the randomness of sprinkling, the paths might have something a little bit random about them, but it has to be Lorentz invariant. So particles, the momentum's going to go on some sort of random walk. And then you can ask how big this effect is. So you think it must be there, but so we've looked for things like that, and we've bounded that very tightly now by looking at various things. So that was a sort of original idea that I had, and then it's been developed by Lydia Philpott at Imperial and some other people. And that's maybe there's some hope for seeing some kind of effect from that. There's a few other ideas, but most of them come down to Yeah, things of that nature. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. I don't know where you're.
Did you? Think you get a natural cut off and organization as well.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. I was just wondering when the next slide is. Oh.